Thank you, Brother Chairman, and good evening, my brothers and sisters, dear and young people, fed and watered, but hopefully on focus. As our Chairman has said, and I apologise for not being able to brief him earlier, we've reversed the last two studies because the one entitled At the Time of the End really is the conclusion of the story, at least for today, and will tie all the threads together, I hope, and especially for those that may not be able to be in attendance tomorrow. We will then be able to have a standalone study tomorrow that that can be looked after or looked at in its own right. So tonight then, in our first study, we're going to look, as our chairman has announced, at the matter of startling developments in Europe, and in particular, the question of how have the sons of Japheth managed to revive the beast at the time of the end, in the last days? Well, we're going to start by looking at the book of Genesis in chapter 10. By the way, maybe it would be very helpful if I mentioned you at the outset of this study, we're going to look at developments in Europe, the revival of the beast. So let me ask you a question. Homework, really. Red line or blue line? It's absolutely right. We're making progress, you see. If you just go away and think, what was it all about? It was about the red line and the blue line. I'd say you absolutely got it, you see. So this is about developments with the red line, because it's part of the system of things that will be in opposition to the truth at the time of the end. So the developments in Europe concerning the beast system are part of the red line at the time of the end. Now, do you notice what Genesis chapter 10 says? And reading together from verse 1. It says, "Now the generations of the sons of Noah, in their several branches of the family, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, well, these were they, born unto them after the flood, the sons of these three different divisions, and first of all, the sons of Japheth," as verse 2 is going to go on and say. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Terez. And the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, and Riphath, and Tagama. And the sons of Javan, Elisha, and Tarshish, and Kittim, and Dedanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. And so what we learn from this is that the sons of Japheth, the stock of Japheth, were the Indo-European races known for their exploratory zeal in colonizing different parts of the world. And in particular, as verse 5 tells us, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided. And of all the sons of Japheth, we believe that Gomer and Magog, the two oldest sons, well, they probably migrated the furthest westwards of all from where the story first started, which obviously is after the time of the flood. Now, these three rivers are significant in tracing the story of their migration. The River Don, the River Danube, and the River Rhine. So let me quote from various writers in conjunction with what actually we're told happened to the sons of Japheth. Josephus tells us that Japheth the son of Noah had seven sons, and beginning at the mountains Taurus and Amanus, they proceeded along Asia as far as the river Tanai, which is the river Don there, and from there along Europe to Cadiz, just beyond the Straits of Gibraltar. And Josephus goes on to say, Gomer founded those whom the Greeks call Galatai, but were then called Gomerites. And Magog founded those that from him were called Magogites, but who are by the Greeks called the Scythi, or the Scythians. And so what we're being told is that Magog was the founder of the Scythi, and Gomer was the founder of the Galatai. Now, you'll notice that we've put them quite a long way westwards into Europe. And that's because, not just of what Josephus says, but what Herodotus says. Herodotus says, the name Scythi was a name given by the Greeks to an ancient and widely extended people of Europe who had spread themselves from the River Don westward along the banks of the Danube. And so although they started in this area here, they started to move westwards and eventually along the River Danube into the very heartland of Europe itself. And finally, Diodorus Siculus says that Scythi or Scythia was above Gaul, extending to the Baltic, and describing that large tract of land that lay above the Rhine. So Magog was to the north of the Rhine, but Gomer was to the south of the Rhine. And so this became part of the ancient dividing line between Gomer and Magog. So here's the two oldest sons of Japheth of Genesis chapter 10 as they migrated across the path and across the face of Europe. And in fact, if we come back to Genesis 10 and ask ourselves the question in verse 2, well, where did the other sons go, not just Gomer and Magog, but Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshach and Teres? Well, let's just see if we can plot those on the chart in terms of their relative positions across that map, perhaps a slightly enlarged map, actually, of that area. So we've got the sons of Japheth in their dispersion. And as we've seen, Gomer really came into the area of what we would call today modern France and the Iberian Peninsula. Magog lay to the north of that and to the east of that in the heartland of Europe and was in fact quite widely spread. Madai, which is the third son mentioned in Genesis 10 verse 2, well, by the way, the word Madai in the Hebrew in Genesis chapter 10 is the same word elsewhere translated Media, or the Medes and the Persians. So the Madai of Genesis 10 verse 2 answers to the area of modern Iran. And then we're told that Javan was the next son, and Javan answers to the area of Greece and the Ionian Peninsula. In fact, the very name Ionian comes from the word Javan. And then we have Tubal. We have Meshach that really began between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, but gradually moved northwards from that area. And lastly, we've got Teres, which, by the way, answers to the area we would call Thracia in Old Testament times, New Testament times, answering to modern Bulgaria and Romania. So this is where the sons of Japheth spread in their migration. And clearly what we're being told is that the sons of Japheth lived where? And the answer is they lived on the European landmass. That was the concentration of where the sons of Japheth were. Well, that brings us to Daniel chapter 7 and to the prophecy that Daniel gives of the four great beasts. And there's something about the prophecy of Daniel 7 that in fact is connected with these sons of Japheth. We're told in Daniel 7, remember, about the vision of Daniel. And he says in Daniel chapter 7, verse 1, that Daniel had a dream. And he said, I saw four great beasts, verse 3, come up from the sea. The first was like a lion, verse 4. The second was like a bear, verse 5. The third was like a leopard, verse 6. And the verse 7 talks about the fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, which of course we believe answers to the next empire. And of course, as we give our lectures, particularly to interested friends, we link Daniel 7 with Daniel chapter 2, don't we? And we show how the head of gold was going to become ultimately the lion of Daniel chapter 7, and the two stages of the lion, and how that the next stage of Medo-Persia was going to become the bear of Daniel chapter 7, and how that the belly and thighs of brass was going to become the winged leopard of Daniel chapter 7, and how the legs of iron of Daniel 2 was going to become the terrible fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. And in fact, perhaps a situation beyond that, remember when three little horns were cast down by one horn which subdued them and grew up on the head of the Roman beast, answering to the divided kingdom stage of later times. So this is what we've traditionally spoken about in Christadelphians concerning the prophecies of Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. Now, what's interesting about those territories, about those empires, is the territory that they cover. So let me now take you from that visual representation of Daniel chapter 7 and into the territory of those particular empires. And now you notice what happens. You see, the Babylonian Empire extended no further westwards than the Mediterranean shores of Palestine. The Medo-Persian Empire got a little further because it comes across Asia Minor, answering to modern Turkey, and across the Bosphorus, well, into the region of Europe itself, but only slightly. But the Grecian Empire extends a little further again, because Greece, of course, would embrace Macedonia and Achaia as part of the dominions of the Grecian Empire. Ah, but when we come to the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, that's the interesting one, because where's the territory of the fourth beast? And the answer is that the territory of the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 is clearly the territory of Europe, isn't it? And what's interesting about Europe is, well, that's where the sons of Japheth live. So the fourth beast of Daniel 7 is somehow critically linked to the story of the sons of Japheth, because they live in the very area where that beast is supposed to be. Now, let me show you something interesting about the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. It says in verse 16, I came near unto one of them that stood by. Daniel 7, verse 16. I came near unto one of them that stood by, and I asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. And he said, these great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom even for ever and ever. Do you know something very remarkable about that particular passage in Daniel chapter 7? Did you notice it, brothers and sisters? Did you notice this? There's no fifth beast. There's only ever four. There's no new Arab animal at the time of the end. It's already established that the fourth beast is Rome. And Daniel 7 explicitly says there's only four. And by the way, it says, verse 18, that the very next thing at the end of the history of the fourth beast is that the saints come and take the kingdom. Ah, so the fourth beast continues down through time until Christ returns. And there's never a fifth to replace it. So we expect some continuation of things Roman right down to the time of the end. And by the way, if that's the case, then we expect the theatre of operations of Bible prophecy to include matters in Europe. And that's Japhethite territory. The beast that lives and roams for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, the Roman beast, is going to live in the lands of the sons of Japheth. There'll never be another one after that. Well, that brings us to Revelation chapter 13. Having established what Daniel says, let's just see what Revelation says. In fact, it might be helpful if I put it this way. If you just look at Revelation 13, it says in verse 1, maybe actually verse 17 of chapter 12 for connection, and the dragon was wroth with the woman. Do you remember? We looked at that passage earlier on. And now it says in chapter 13, I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And so we've got another beast arising out of the sea. And then in verse 11 it says, And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And we suddenly realise, as we come to the book of Revelation, that, well, there's going to be some more beasts. But let me tell you what's interesting about the beasts of the book of Revelation. And you'll see the logic of this in terms of our structure, our framework for Bible prophecy. Because what happens is Daniel's beast of Daniel chapter 7, the fourth beast, is going to become the dragon of Revelation chapter 7, chapter 12, which in turn is going to become the beast of the sea of Revelation chapter 13, which in turn is going to be represented in the beast of the earth of Revelation chapter 13 later in the chapter. And finally, in Revelation chapter 17, we're going to have another manifestation of the beast with a woman riding the beast at the time of the end. But the interesting thing is they're all successive manifestations of the same beast. Daniel's fourth beast. Remember, there's never a fifth. And so the Roman Empire and its central religion, the Roman Catholic Church, and its successive stages of manifestation, well, they span the centuries of time from the apostles of the first century to our own time with modern Europe under the influence of the papacy. And the story of the book of Revelation, as we shall see later on, is going to be the story of Daniel's seventh beast, simply stretched out in more detail into its successive stages down through time. Now, what's also interesting about this, if I just perhaps look at that in a slightly different way in graphic and dramatic form, let me just show you now those beasts of Revelation chapter 13 and their approximate placings on the European map, because again, it's quite significant where they were. So if we come to the territory of the European system and to those stages of the Roman beast, what we've got is this. We've got the beast of the sea that arises in verse 1. And that beast of the sea, we believe, answers to France and the Latin kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula, who were all under the control of the papacy. Whereas the phrase "the dragon" mentioned earlier in the chapter, "the dragon gave him his power," answers to the military power of things that were established in the east and based in Constantinople. The beast of the earth, that will appear later on in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11, is in the very heartland of Europe itself, in the centre of the European territory. And that beast of the earth will largely be centred in Germany and its surrounding dominions. And lastly, we're going to have the image of the beast, which will be a reflection of the papacy in the middle, based in Rome and on the peninsula of Italy. So these are the stages of Revelation chapter 13. Now, what's interesting about the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea in particular is that those two beasts territorially largely have reference to Gomer and to Magog, to France and to Germany. In fact, they followed two parallel lines of development in their history, because there was a kingdom centred in France called Neustria, and a kingdom centred in Germany called Austrasia, and those two kingdoms side by side were largely Gomer and Magog on the face of Europe. In fact, one man arose who finally combined those two kingdoms together. What was his name? Charlemagne. Charlemagne the Great, who combined those two parts, and for the first time, as it were, in the Frankish dominion of Charlemagne, the kingdom of the beast of the earth and the kingdom of the beast of the sea and the lands of Gomer and the lands of Magog were joined together in one giant empire right in the heartland of Europe. And that was the legacy of what Charlemagne brought. He ruled over both. And you know that ever since the time of Charlemagne, there's been a dream, hasn't there? A dream of European leaders that one day perhaps they could unite Europe just like that again. Of course, many have tried. Lots of European leaders have tried, and they've never quite managed to do that, have they? Let me show you the map of what it was like in the days of Charlemagne in terms of the extent of that empire, which of course was really the Holy Roman Empire as Charlemagne established it, based in Aachen, his headquarters. When Charlemagne died in the year AD 814, that was the extent of the dominion of Charlemagne's empire. And if we were to put the words Gomer and Magog across the top of that, you'll find that it neatly covered both of those areas. But his sons didn't have Charlemagne's acumen or military prowess, and as a result of that, they lost territory. In fact, the territory began to divide, so much so that if we come forward in the history of the Holy Roman Empire to 1189 and to the death of Frederick I, you'll notice now, well, what's happened? What's happened to the Holy Roman Empire? It's starting to shrink out of France and into Germany. Do you notice that? It's starting to travel, in fact, to the east. And if we were to come even further on to the death of Maximilian, now Maximilian died in 1519, and notice now that the empire has shrunk even further to the east and is in the heartland of modern Germany, but right out of France. Now, you may not be able to see this at the back, but let me put a little bit of smidgen of colour here on just between, can you see that little line of blue colour there? Between, you see, that's the ancient dividing line between Gomer and Magog. And there's been lots of leaders ever since, in the form of a Hitler or a Bismarck or a Napoleon and others, who sought to, in fact, reunite those two sides and to bring Gomer and Magog back. But none of them have been able to do that. There's been an ancient dividing line between the two. And frankly, those two particular powers, Gomer and Magog, have been at war for a long time. Now, finally, what we find in the book of Revelation, chapter 16, which we won't turn to, is the power of the beast was destroyed. And we believe that that dissolution of the beast system took place around about 1806 as a result of the vile judgments of Revelation chapter 16. But what's interesting is that when we come to look at Revelation in more detail, it becomes clear that the Bible requires a latter-day beast. I think we can be quite convinced of that. So remember what we said about prophetic applications. We'd need evidence, wouldn't we, that there is some contextual proof or warrant for a latter-day application. Well, here it is. In Revelation chapter 14 it says, "And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast in his image." Do you know how Revelation chapter 14 starts? "I saw the Lamb upon Mount Zion." So this is set at the time of the return of Christ, and yet it talks about a beast as if there's a beast there at the time. And likewise, Revelation chapter 15, which says, "I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire." Do you know what the sea of glass mingled with fire is? It's the judgments of Christ upon the nations to subdue them. And yet in the very context of that moment of time in history when Christ comes to subdue the nations, it talks about those that had gotten victory over the beast as if they're still alive, and that so is the beast. And even more clear, of course, is Revelation chapter 16, which says, "I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet." But didn't Revelation 16 say that those mouths are going to gather together the kings of the Oikumene to the battle of Armageddon? But something comes out of the mouth of the beast at that time in Revelation 16. Revelation 17 says, "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them." So when the Lamb comes to do battle, there's a beast there. Clearly a beast. Absolutely clear. They give their strength and power to the beast, and they make war with the Lamb when the Lamb returns. And lastly, Revelation chapter 19 says, "And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet, and they were both cast into the lake of fire, alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone." There's a latter-day beast. Clearly a scriptural indication that there must be a latter-day beast, a beast at the time of the end. Now, what it doesn't say, what none of those chapters say, brothers and sisters, is which beast it might be. Is it the beast of the earth, or is it the beast of the sea, of Revelation chapter 13? Well, my particular view is it's probably a combination of both, a revival of both at the time of the end. And if it is, well, then we'd expect the latter-day beast to include both France and Germany. In fact, they'd need to be at the very heart of any latter-day beast because, well, that's where the two beasts were in biblical times earlier. They were centred in Gomer and Magog. Now, again, the remarkable thing, really, about Bible prophecy is how we don't realise how time is constantly moving forward. That's a map of modern Europe, and the lines that demarcate the nations are necessarily greyed out there, but the implication of that map is that Europe has long been a disparate collection of independent nations. And in fact, if we went back 150 years, it would be even worse. 150 years ago, the map of Europe was a hopeless state of fragmentation. And by the way, Gomer and Magog historically were at war 150 years ago. The two oldest sons of Japheth struggling for supremacy across the face of Europe. 100 years ago, this situation of a uniting of Gomer and Magog looked impossible. Perhaps almost even around about 50 years ago, this looked impossible. And all of a sudden, as it were, out of the blue, in what seemed to be, by the way, a very innocuous start, something happened that launched a force that would revive the beast system at the time of the end, and that revival would be led, in fact, by none other than the sons of Japheth in their due time. And that remarkable development was the formation of the European Steel and Coal Commission in 1952. Now, why that's significant, it predates the Treaty of Rome, by the way, by a few years. And the Treaty of Rome, which is considered to be the start of the European Union, was signed, as we've mentioned before, in 1957 in the Lateran Palace. But before that, just a few years before, they signed the European Coal and Steel Commission. And what that treaty was about was simply this, that France said to Germany, how about we combine our coal and steel supplies under our joint national control? And you know, France only did that for one reason, because Germany had already plunged Europe into so many wars that France said, enough. Let's combine our coal and steel supplies. Why those supplies? Because Germany could never rearm if France jointly controlled those particular resources. And so the signing of that particular document was really a very important one in terms of the beginning of rapprochement in the European scene. And that was added to by means of an even more remarkable document that was signed in 1963. Now, some of you may have seen these particular slides, but for me, for my particular point, I never lose the amazement of what's happened in the last few years and how dramatically it's moved things forward. Because what happened in 1963, on the 22nd of January, is two elderly men sat down in the Elysee Palace in Paris and signed what was called the Franco-German Friendship Treaty. It was signed by President Charles de Gaulle on the one side, who was age 73, and by Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, who was age 89, on the German side. And after these two elderly men had signed that document, the Franco-German Friendship Treaty, they got up and they wept tears and they embraced, because they truly felt that they had put the hereditary enmity between Gomer and Magog finally to rest with the signing of that friendship treaty. And that year, the Pope issued a highly significant encyclical called Pacem in Terris, which means peace on earth, because Gomer and Magog had shaken hands and all was well. Well, actually, what happened from that point on was nothing short of surprising, because what that treaty provided for was this. It's called, by the way, Franco-German Day now in both France and Germany. 22nd of January, famous day, Franco-German Day. And what it provided for was that the heads of state would meet twice a year. And not only the heads of state, but the foreign ministry officials would have 12 meetings a year to set up meetings for the foreign ministry officials, who'd meet four times a year, at least at ministerial level, and also they would attend what was called the Defence and Security Council meeting. There would be a meeting of the coordinators for Franco-German unity of twice per year, and the defence ministers would also meet four times a year and contribute to the Defence and Security Council meeting. And lastly, there would be a joint ambassadorial conference once per year, an environmental council meeting twice a year, and a cultural council twice a year. Think about this, a joint ambassadorial conference. That means that all the ambassadors from France and all the ambassadors from Germany get together in a hotel and have a joint conference. That's unprecedented. Despite your remarkable friendship with Canada, I'm sure that you wouldn't have a joint ambassadorial conference with them. At least I don't think so. Now, one of the interesting things about that particular structure was that, in effect, what it did is it laid the framework for what we might call an unprecedented level of cooperation between those two powers. And since that treaty, it's been revised at least twice, and each time it's been revised, the document has been strengthened. Of course, the burning question was, it's all very well to have a treaty, and it's all very well for de Gaulle and for Adenauer to sign the document, but what about subsequent leaders? How would they get on? What if they didn't like each other? What if there was personal rivalry? Well, somehow what's happened is that down through the sweep of time, it's almost as if the leaders of Gomer and Magog have sensed that this was such an important thing that they've put aside their personal differences in order that they might collaborate together. And so we've had a succession of remarkable personal friendships. So it began with Konrad Adenauer and Charles de Gaulle, and then it was followed by Helmut Schmidt and Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who got on remarkably well. And then there was Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand, who were actually poles apart in lots of ways, but ended up the best of friends in terms of the promotion of this treaty. And then we had Gerhard Schroeder and Jacques Chirac. Now that was a very odd coupling of people. But they got on because they were committed to the terms of this treaty. And now we have Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, and guess what? They're getting on. Because this treaty almost is so important that it overrides personal considerations. Do you know that Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand, in the 8 years from 1982 to 1989, they had a number of state meetings, two heads of state. Think about, you know, let's say the Prime Minister of Australia would come to visit the President of America. And they're good friends, because after all, they've collaborated in different parts of the world, want to support each other as well. How many times would you expect the head of state to meet those two heads of state? Once a year? Twice a year? Three times a year? Three times a year? Oh, I don't think so. Not a head of state meeting. Do you know that Mitterrand and Kohl, in the 8 years from 82 to 89, had 80 personal meetings? 80. 80 head of state meetings. And in the years 1982 to 1984, their two foreign ministers, Hans-Dietrich Genscher and Claude Cheysson, had 1,000 telephone calls between them in 3 years. 1,000 foreign ministry telephone calls. This is serious stuff. That's very serious cooperation. It's an unprecedented level of cooperation. And as we've said, that treaty has proven to be highly resilient to leadership changes down through time. In fact, let me just look at that a little bit further, because this is what that treaty has driven. By the way, we'd call it, of course, the Magog-Gomer Pact, wouldn't we, from a biblical perspective, rather than the Franco-German Friendship Treaty. It's all driven from here, you see. And so this treaty established a requirement for Franco-German consultation on foreign policy, security, and defence issues, and that the two nations strive to reconcile their viewpoints and seek a common position. And in an extract from a Harvard paper which I read on this particular treaty, it says, "The treaty crowned a process of reconciliation and irrevocably ended the times of Franco-German hereditary enmity, and it was that enmity that prevented the beast from ever being revived." And all of a sudden, they signed a treaty. And my word, have things started to develop since the time that Gomer and Magog got together. And in fact, what's happening that's so remarkable is, well, let me show you some of the initiatives over the last few years. They come in fits and starts, but they're all heading in a certain direction. Who's revived the beast? Well, the sons of Japheth in general. But if you were to really say who's been driving it, where's the engine room, you'll find it's, surprise, surprise, Magog and Gomer. These have been the great initiators of changes in European matters. It's been driven by them through and through. In fact, I think I've got a slide here of some of the more recent developments that have occurred under the terms of that Treaty of Friendship, because there have been some remarkable movements. In 1993 was the Maastricht Treaty, the foundation European document that really advanced things, because in that same year, the single European market was created. And again, in that same year, the European Monetary Union Agreement was established. In 1993, also, Eurocorp was established, which was known as the Rapid Response Force. I'll come back to that a little bit later on. In 1998, the European Central Bank was established. In 1998, the euro was launched. And in 2002, we had the blueprint of a European constitution, which suggested a merging of all previous European treaties, the establishment of a European president, a European diplomatic corps, and embassies. A European diplomatic corps? So what would happen is you would no longer have an embassy of Germany or an embassy of France here in America. You'd have an embassy of Europe, the beast system. As if they've surrendered their national sovereignty to something, some creature that's taken on a life of its own in Europe, and they've created it and breathed life into it by means of all of these initiatives. In fact, I was in Germany on the day that the euro was launched, and there were all these rows of faithful Germans marching in to the bank to change good Deutschmark for new crisp euros. And the reason behind that was this. It's long been said, if you can get people to use the same money, in the end, you'll unite them. Common currency starts to do away with feelings of difference. And of course, it isn't just common currency, isn't it? Those initiatives, of course, have resulted in no border controls between the border states of the European Union. You can travel freely, and wherever you buy, you use the same money to buy anything you like. It's all very simple. It's like a new system developing. There was one notable occasion, by the way, where in the United Nations, the representative of Germany wasn't available to vote. And so the unprecedented matter occurred of Jacques Chirac, the president of France, actually casting a vote on behalf of the nation of Germany in the United Nations. Can you believe that? It's really quite remarkable. If you went to Paris today and walked into the Foreign Ministry building, you might be surprised to pop your head over a cubicle and hear someone saying, "Die Welt braucht dein Nacht, die Garden in Ubisheen." And you think, that doesn't sound French. And the answer is, no, it's not. It's a German from the German Foreign Embassy doing his course of duty on a swap in the French Foreign Embassy. And if you went to the German Foreign Embassy in Berlin, popped your head over one of the cubicles, you might hear, "Combien de documents avez-vous de votre document, monsieur?" And you suddenly realise there's a Frenchman there looking over German papers of German foreign policy. A Frenchman there. What's he doing there? It was all part of the Franco-German Treaty that they exchange people and their foreign ministries. It's absolutely unprecedented that that would be the case. And yet we're seeing that in front of our own eyes right now. And so the whole treaty, the whole process of European Union has been driven, in fact, by those two powers. In fact, did I move that on? Let me just go back a step and just show you that again. So those particular initiatives, what's interesting about them, the treaty, the European market, the monetary union agreement, the establishment of the Rapid Response Force, the creation of the central bank, the launching of the euro, the blueprint of the constitution, all, every one of those, driven by France and Germany. They're all Franco-German initiatives. Gomer and Magog are driving the story of the revival of the beast at the time of the end. In fact, let me show you where the key centres are of what we might describe as the latter-day beast. This is where they are. The key centres. Now watch carefully. See if you can spot something rather interesting. Brussels, Luxembourg, Strasbourg. Do you notice where they are? They all straddle the ancient dividing line between Gomer and Magog. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? They were careful, you see, which cities they chose. There's one particular city that's out of order and out of sequence, and that's that one there called Frankfurt. But the Germans had a very good reason for putting something there. So what is there? Well, in Brussels we've got the European Commission, the European Council, the European Economic and Social Committee, and what's called the Committee of the Regions. In Luxembourg, we've got the European Court of Justice, the European Court of Auditors, and the European Investment Bank. And of course, in Strasbourg itself, we've got the European Parliament, the European Ombudsman, and the location of the European Eurocorps force. And what's in Frankfurt? Simple, really. The European Central Bank. And you see, of course, you know what the golden rule is, don't you, brothers and sisters? He who has the gold rules. And when the Germans set up the European Central Bank, they said, I think we might have that in Frankfurt, thank you. And the fiscal policy of that bank, even though it's European, is very much driven by the German banking system and not the French. Now, what's remarkable about all this, brothers and sisters, is that this is what Napoleon couldn't do. This is what Bismarck couldn't do, what Hitler couldn't do. Instead, through social and economic and political activity, there's been this tremendous revival of the beast system, as it were, at the time of the end. And by the way, our expectation of these things isn't just driven by the book of Revelation. Because if you come back to Ezekiel chapter 38, in a chapter that I'm sure you've never seen before, it says this in Ezekiel 38, in a remarkable prophecy. So here it is. Ezekiel chapter 38. And let's just remind ourselves of what's there. Now in Ezekiel 38, it says, verse 1, says, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And you'll know the story of the nations that are unfolded as a result in Ezekiel chapter 38. Just notice this, though. Oh, I even got the right colour, didn't I? That's the red line. And you see, we've got Rosh and Meshech and Tubal in the middle. But do you notice we've got Magog in verse 2 and Gomer in verse 6. There they are, the two oldest boys. Magog verse 2 and Gomer verse 6. They are part of the confederacy of nations that come down into the Middle East at the time of the end. And if we were to say, therefore, what's Ezekiel 38 all about? It's about the story of the beast system of Revelation at the time of the end. This is the confederacy. Now, just notice one other interesting thing about those names. And that's this. Actually, I'll just put the blue line on as well. Then we've completed the story, haven't we? So now we've got the blue line. Israel and Dedan and Sheba and Tarshish. Oh, by the way, that's tomorrow morning study. So don't miss it. Get up. That's tomorrow morning study before the memorial meeting, God willing. Of course, you'll be up early anyway, because we're all going to be at the baptism, aren't we? That's right, I'd quite forgotten. Now, do you know what's interesting about the red line of that old map of things European concerning Ezekiel 38? There's not an Arab nation in sight. Not an Arab name mentioned in the controversy. This is Babylon at the time of the end. Oh yes, as it turns out, there may be some Arab collaborators, but they're clearly not the basis of the story, are they? So what we've got in Ezekiel 38 is really the same story as the revival of the beast at the time of the end in the book of Revelation, when the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth, as it were, come together at the time of the end. So let me talk about some of the expectations that we might have as a result of those developments which have been taking place in Europe and clearly are quite remarkable. Here's the first one, which, by the way, the French won't like at all. And that's this, that I think biblically we have expectation of the fact that Magog is going to dominate the proceedings in the beast system as time moves on. And one of the reasons for that is that although Gomer's mentioned in verse 6, she's sort of down the list, really. But Magog, verse 2, he's right in the heart of it. Gog of the land of the Magog. Magog is right at the core of the rebellion of Ezekiel 38, as if Magog has a dominant position at the very centre of the controversy. And I think that that's the case because, do you remember what Ezekiel 39 says in the next chapter? It says that after the defeat of Gog and Israel, it says that I will send a fire upon Magog. Not upon Gomer, notice, upon Magog. And the judgments of God are turned upon Germany as the primary force in the war that follows in Europe after the Battle of Armageddon. In addition to that, if we come to the post-millennial revolt of Revelation chapter 20, you remember at the end of 1,000 years of Christ's reign, there's a last revolt, a last rebellion. Do you remember that? And the protagonists are called, why, Gog and Magog, as if to suggest that that rebellion in pre-millennial times is going to become the type, as it were, of that final post-millennial revolt, and it's going to be like a Gog and a Magog, says the record, all over again. So I think that we have a biblical reason for concluding that we anticipate a continued increase in Magog's influence in Germany until it becomes the dominant force in the European Union. Now, you might like to turn to Revelation chapter 17, because in Revelation chapter 17, we've got really the nub of what we want to draw our attention to in terms of our expectations biblically at the time of the end. I want to talk about two of those ideas in particular that we might just see how remarkable developments are. So what are our biblical expectations then concerning the beast system at the time of the end? Well, here's the first one. I think we expect to see, as we've seen, the increasing dominance of Magog until it becomes the driving force behind the European Union. Do you know that that's been happening for some time now? And you know what the turning point was? It was Gomer and Magog, and it was all fine until a certain critical turning point in history, and that was the time that Germany reunited the two halves of Germany. And since the reunification of Germany, Germany has become increasingly more and more influential in European affairs. And we expect biblically that that's going to be a situation that's likely to increase even further. I think also we expect to see the increasing influence of Roman Catholicism in Magog, or greater progress towards a Roman Catholic Lutheran reconciliation. Now, by the way, why would we say that? Well, for one simple reason. Because the beast of Revelation 17, which is the latest, the last, the final stage of the beast, isn't just a beast. It's a beast being ridden by a woman. And that woman represents the religious system of Roman Catholicism, does it not? Babylon the Great, who directs the beast. So I think one of the things we expect as the beast system develops at the time of the end is a greater influence of Roman Catholicism, and in particular in Magog, to direct events even further. And the fact, as we've said before, is that the current pontiff is German, is perhaps interesting in that regard, in terms of influence he might be able to bring to bear on Roman Catholic Lutheran reconciliation in his own home country. And I think in addition to that, we expect to see the increasing economic prosperity of the European Union that will establish a strong global position. I don't mean by that that you should go out and buy European stocks and bonds tomorrow and dump your American subprime mortgage debt, although that probably wouldn't be a bad idea. But clearly, from a biblical point of view, we expect that there's going to be signs of increasing prosperity in the European Union at the time of the end. And here are the two that I particularly want to talk about tonight. I think we expect to see the increasing momentum of the European Union towards establishing a separate political entity distinct from the individual states that it represents. And lastly, I think we expect to see the increasing likelihood of the member states to seek the militarization of the European Union rather than the development of their national forces. Well, let me put the quotations in first, and then we'll talk about those last two points. Now, read Revelation chapter 17 then, with me, and just read particularly verses 12 and 13. I want you to think about how powerful this is. It says, "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast." Now stop and think about what it's saying. It's saying here that the 10 horns, the 10 kings, the various nations that go to make up Europe are going to do this, remarkably, verse 13. They're going to have one mind, and they're going to give their power and their strength unto the beast. Now, who or what is the beast? And the answer is, well, the beast is the European Union, which should have just been originally some sort of trading alliance that allowed the member states to carry on as individual nations, but trade together and collaborate for that purpose. But as the European Union has grown, it's taken on, you know, no pardon for the pun here, a life of its own. So much so now that what the member states are suggesting under the new European Constitution is that they will actually develop a European diplomatic corps and a European set of embassies. And someone from Europe will represent not Italy or Germany or France, but Europe. As if Europe's a nation somehow. But it's not a nation, brothers and sisters. Ah, but it is. Or at least it's heading that way. And by the way, you'll probably know that one of the members of the European Parliament is Otto von Habsburg, who was actually the descendant of the Habsburgs of the Holy Roman Empire. And he has long said that we need to have one leader at the top with political supremacy who speaks on behalf of Europe. We ought to have a European president. And that European president, well, he should be able to speak at things like the United Nations on behalf of the European community and with full political authority. Oh, and by the way, said Otto von Habsburg, two things. He should be elected for life. Oh, and by the way, when we elect him, I've got a crown that I think he should wear. Quite an interesting sort of president, really. A life president. And wearing a crown. Of course, you know what crown Otto von Habsburg believes that the president of Europe should wear? It's the iron crown of Charlemagne the Great, which they've still got. And von Habsburg believes that that crown should be placed upon the titular head of the European Union to indicate his political authority over that whole enterprise. That is unbelievable, brothers and sisters, that political discussion should be taking place to that extent. Because what that's saying is exactly what Revelation 17 says, that they will give... We see what it says, by the way. It says they'll give their power and their strength, verse 13, unto the beast. Now, the word power there is the word dunamis, which means force. And I believe in this context it means their military force. Whereas the word strength is the word exousia, which means authority. And I think that refers to their political force. They're going to give their dunamis, their power, their military strength, and their political authority to the beast. They're going to surrender their national sovereignty with regard to politics and militarization and say, let the beast take care of it for us. Now, do you know, brothers and sisters, even 50 years ago, we would have looked at Bible prophecy and puzzled how that could possibly take place. And now it's heading in that very direction. The possibility of a European president. Absolutely remarkable. And not only that, but when it says, by the way, that they'll give their power, their dunamis... Of course, what happened, remember, is that in 1993 they established what was called, you remember, the European Response Force. Now, what they said when they did that, they said, look, it's only a little thing, really. It's just in case there's a wee emergency in Europe somewhere and we need a few chaps to, you know, quickly go and deal with it. It'll never be important, just the European Rapid Response Force. And then as the Rapid Response Force idea took root, they said, well, you know, maybe we could... what we found is this force is a little bit small for some of the things that we had in mind. And after all, we need to help in Afghanistan and Kosovo. And we need something with a little more, you know, European substance to help around the world. Well, maybe we'll boost it a little bit. Just a little group. Maybe 60,000 people. And then as that response force grew, they said, actually, you know... Really, when you think about it, some of these NATO bases aren't really necessary anymore. We're big now and grown up, and we can probably do a bit of this ourselves, don't you think? And by the way, I've been to a brother and sister's place in Germany who live in Kornwestheim. I happen to know the place very well because they're now related to me. And just down the road was one of the American bases, one of the NATO bases. It's all gone. It's empty. It's all been demolished. They've all withdrawn. And you see, 50 years ago, brothers and sisters knew that NATO was in Europe, and you never talked about a European army. That you would have washed your mouth out. That was a disgraceful thing to suggest. You just didn't do that. And now they're talking about it. And Angela Merkel has said, I want to develop the European army with as much speed as I possibly can. Because, of course, what they've found is this, is that when they have brought the European Rapid Response Force together and sent them off to any part of the world, it's been an absolute shambles. Because the French and the Spanish and the Italian and the Germans are all using different telephones and different receivers and different protocols and different blueprints and different this and different that. It's a nightmare. And Angela Merkel has said, we need to bring all this together and, simplify, and we want a European army. They shall give their strength and power unto the beast. Well, it's happening, brothers and sisters, right before our very eyes. And I think that's absolutely exciting and remarkable that that should be so. And do you see what it says in the next verse? The very next verse. It says, and these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And what we're being told is that when all of those scriptural indications come to pass, we're on the very eve of the return of the Lamb, that system, that beast system, might do battle with the Lord Jesus Christ. How marvellous to think that we're living on the very eve of those things being fulfilled. I don't think that we need to see any of this before Christ's return. I think that what we have seen, we're privileged to have seen, that our faith might be strengthened. And of course, you see what it says, verse 14. That isn't just the Lamb that overcomes them. It says, and they that are with him, that are called and chosen and faithful. So the saints won't be debating when the Lord comes, will they, brothers and sisters? Who the beast might be. Or at least they shouldn't be, should they? We should be giving public lectures about dramatic events that are signs of the times, of the nearness of our Lord's return, and the need for people to prepare their lives in expectation of the imminent arrival of he who is called the Lamb and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And we need to have a clear view on prophecy so that we know the significance of all these events. This is the red line developing before our very eyes, leading to the final struggle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. All brothers and sisters, that our hearts might be charged with the excitement of the times in which we live. It's really happening right now. Under our noses. So let's be thankful for the sure word of prophecy and prepare ourselves for the coming of the Lord. Be thankful that when he comes, that despite all of the power and authority and terribleness of that great and dreadful fourth beast, that the great paradox of the Revelation record is that a little lamb will conquer it all.